don't frighten us, English pig dogs. I fart in your general direction. Your mother was a hamster, and your father smelt of elderberries.
Run away! Okay, don't. Not really. It's long been one of my dreams as a radio host to talk to the magnificent John Cleese. You heard him there in the 1975 classic Monty Python and the Holy Grail, of course. And recently, my dream came true. Almost. My co-host Anthony Brooks got to talk to Cleese just after the release of the comedian's memoir called So Anyway.
And I've got to say, Anthony, it's the most enjoyable thing I've done for a long time because people are almost disappointed to hear this. I actually love writing much more than I love acting. Not to say I can't have fun acting, but writing's more satisfying.
More satisfying than playing Basil Fawlty? More satisfying than polyglot sex scenes with Jamie Lee Curtis in A Fish Called Wanda? More satisfying than not being able to buy Venezuelan beaver cheese in a classic Monty Python sketch? Well, yes, apparently, as we found out when Anthony spoke with John Cleese last November. They started by listening back to that Python skit about the cheese shop that doesn't seem to have any cheese.
Gouda?
No.
Edam?
No.
Caseless?
No.
Smoked Austrian?
No.
Sage Derby?
No, sir.
You do have some cheese, do you?
Oh, certainly, sir. It's a cheese shop, sir. We've got...
No, don't tell me. I'm keen to guess.
Fair enough.
Winsleydale?
Yes, sir.
Splendid! Well, I'll have some of that then, please.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. I thought you were referring to me. Mr. Winsleydale.
So, John Cleese, where does an idea like that come from? A cheese shop with no cheese.
I had a period shooting for Python on film on a boat, and I was extremely seasick. And on the way home to London, Graham suggested that I might need something to eat, and I said I'd fancy some cheese. And so we started looking for a cheese shop. And we just hit upon the idea of a cheese shop that was actually out of cheese, and it struck us very funny. The most satisfactory moment I ever had in 5 years of doing Monty Python the television is that at the read-through when I read it out, Michael Palin started to laugh and he absolutely couldn't control himself. He slid off his chair onto the floor and just lay there rolling around. And that, for me, was the best moment in Monty Python.
It seems, though, that skits like this, they seem to express a certain common frustration that a lot of us have when we deal with, I don't know, public officials, bureaucracies, or in this case, a stubborn salesman. I mean, it just seems to tap into something universal. Would you agree with that?
I think if people recognize the experience themselves, they find it funnier. I always point out that comedy is not about people behaving well and intelligently, or about things going right. If they go right and perfect, there's nothing funny. I remember a TV executive once said to me, show me a sitcom about St. Francis of Assisi and I'll show you a bummer.
I wonder where your funny bone comes from, if I can use that expression, because you might think that it would come from your parents, but you write that your father was a quiet, polite figure. Your mother...
Yes, but he had a very nice, dry sense of humor. I remember once we were watching television and there was a particularly inane dance routine, and he said to me at the end of it, I remember he turned to me and he just said, I don't think this will ever replace entertainment, do you? And it was in that very dry way that he made me laugh, whereas mother had a very different sense of humor, which is really quite black. But it was really one of the few areas where she and I were able to communicate and laugh together.
Oh, interesting. So it was through this sort of black sense of humor that you could connect with her.
I think I had a sense of humor anyway. It's just I think it was more nurtured in those two ways by my mum and dad's very different sense of humor.
So another thing that I was really surprised to read in your book is that you admit that you're an introvert. And I'm wondering if that helped your comedy or made it harder to be a comic.
I think it probably made me a little bit shyer about going in front of audiences. But like anything, people are always anxious in front of audiences. But the thing that gets you over it is simply experience. You know, the first time you walk out onto the center court at Wimbledon, it must be quite bizarre. But if you've won three or four championships there and you walk out, you know, it's another Wimbledon final. So it's experience gets you over all that stuff.
John Cleese, I want to play another clip. This is another great one for Monty Python's Flying Circus. This is the famous dead parrot skit. When you've returned to a pet store to return a parrot that you've just bought because he is dead, the salesman insists that he's just resting, but you push back and insist that he acknowledge the truth.
This parrot is no more. It has ceased to be. It's expired and gone to meet its maker. This is a late parrot. It's a stiff, bereft of life. It rests in peace. If you hadn't nailed it to the perch, it would be pushing up the daisies. It's run down the curtain and joined the choir invisible. This is an ex-parrot.
It still makes me laugh out loud. And John Cleese, I've got to say, your comedy, you know, I have a wonderful staff, and in our newsroom, there are probably at least three generations of people. Everyone knew that almost by heart. And by the way, it's on the cover of The Economist. There, it shows a dead parrot. Yeah, yeah. Let me. If you don't know this, you should see it. So on the front page of The Economist, there's a picture of a dead parrot, and the headline is Europe's Economy, and there's a picture of German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying, "It's only resting."
Very satisfactory. Well, you know, you say that there's three generations of people working around you, and I'm going to say a most outrageous thing, which is that the people who are attracted to my sense of humor do tend to be fairly bright. And NPR does have some pretty intelligent people working there. If I go to a gas station in Missouri or Mississippi, I don't think I'm likely to be recognized. It is a more intellectual type of humor, because it's playing with abstract ideas. And Python's got that slightly intelligent side to it, that sometimes something that seems completely silly does in fact have an idea under it. And people who are brighter and better at abstract thinking tend to glom onto that.
Well, I love it that I'm the first to tell you about this cover on The Economist, but what do you make of that, that this joke has endured so well? This skit has sort of, I don't know, become part of our international consciousness here.
Anthony, it's a complete mystery to me, because the extraordinary thing about comedy is that you never know what is going to catch on and what isn't. What I find is that I think I know now that something's going to be funny, but I can never tell whether people are going to think it's a little bit funny or a lot funny. And if you listen to The Dead Parrot the very first time it was ever recorded in 69, the audience laughter is not that great. But once we started doing it on stage on a regular basis, something happened, and suddenly everybody fell in love with the sketch, and it became, as they say, iconic. But it was absolutely unpredictable.
You know, you mentioned your collaboration with Graham Chapman, and I wanted to ask you about another point you make in the book. I think you say something like, good comedy is teamwork.
When I sit down to write, normally, I have written with someone else. Graham, or I wrote to 40 Towers with Connie Booth. And then when I've been involved in other things, I've loved to work with other people, because I feel that the two of us together, listening and bouncing off each other, we will get somewhere that we would never have got on our own. The thing about Monty Python, for example, is that all great teams have people who are good at completely different things. I mean, the Pythons are not very similar people. We make comedy that makes people laugh, or at least we did, God knows how many years ago, but we're not at all similar. I mean, I'm quite like Michael, but I'm not remotely like the others.
Sure. Well, you've mentioned Fawlty Towers, and I want to ask you about Fawlty Towers, because I just loved that series. It's about, of course, a dysfunctional hotel. You wrote this series, starred in it with your former wife, Connie Booth. And so here's a scene from an episode in which your character, Basil Fawlty, is waiting on German guests, and despite your best attempts not to talk about the war, It's all you can talk about.
So, it's all forgotten now, and let's hear no more about it. So that's two egg mayonnaise, a prawn Goebbels, a Hermann Göring, and four colded salads. Oh, wait a minute, I got a bit confused here. Sorry, I got a bit confused because everyone keeps mentioning the war. So could you... What's the matter?
It's all right.
Is there something wrong?
Will you stop talking about the war?
Me? You started it?
We did not start it.
Yes, you did. You invaded Poland.
It's got one of my favorite jokes of all time.
It's a great one.
And that's when Basil says, now, the hors d'oeuvres. And then he stiffens and says, the hors d'oeuvres that must be obeyed at all times without question. one of my favorite terrible puns of all time.
It's great. I want to ask you about this. You're such a good physical comedian. And I'm thinking about the Ministry of Silly Walks as one example. But I learned from your book that you were very self-conscious about your body growing up. You were very tall, even as a very young boy. You weren't athletic. So how did you learn to use your body to comedic advantage, I guess?
I think I kind of taught myself how to do it because I was the most terrible dancer you've ever seen in your life. But I think what happened was I was not a natural mover, but I was perfectly capable of figuring out a series of movements in my head, and then to keep practicing them until they came really smoothly and relatively effortlessly, as they did in the Silly Walks. But I didn't just get up and perform that. I rehearsed the Silly Walk and invented it in the corridor of my little apartment by trying this step and then that step and then a different step and then finding something that worked and then keeping that and tried to find something else and then discovered I could kick my foot right up into the hair, up to the level of my head, and that seemed to be funny. So I put it together almost intellectually, and then I practiced it like you practice a golf swing until it becomes more or less automatic.
I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, but I'm afraid my walk has become rather sillier recently, and so it takes me rather long.
Let me jump ahead, because I want to talk a little bit about the 1988 film A Fish Called Wanda, which I loved. It starred you, Jamie Lee Curtis, Kevin Kline, and Michael Palin. And there's a scene that's always stayed with me when your character, Archie, is about to seduce Wanda, played by the gorgeous Jamie Lee Curtis, and she asks you this.
Do you speak Italian?
I am Italian. Sono italiano in spirito, ma ho sposato una donna che preferisce lavorare nel giardino a far l'amore appassionato un spalio grande.
But it's such an ugly language.
How about Russian?
Okay, and so during the scene, we see Jamie Lee Curtis being pushed into a kind of sexual delirium by your Russian monologue. I just love that scene. Can you tell me something about filming that? Why it works so well?
I think it's a very good example of what I said earlier, is that you can never tell what's going to be very funny or what's going to be slightly funny. Now, when we found Jamie rolling around on that rope, we discovered it was twice as funny as we thought. And so we extended it with some very clever editing. I recorded, just in sound, not film, an extra verse of the Russian. And they extended that scene by 100% just because Jamie was being so funny. But it never struck me it was going to get so many laughs.
You said something in your book that I am really interested in having you elaborate on. You said that you distinguish between being funny and being clever or witty. What's the difference?
I think that there's always an emotional aspect to being really funny. If I think of something that made me howl with laughter, I think of Eddie Murphy crossing the freeway in Bowfinger. Wit is something that's purely verbal and doesn't, and there are some very funny, witty people around. I think probably Mark Twain was the best, you know. I mean, Mark Twain said, Wagner's music is much better than it sounds. I mean, that's a stunning joke, but it's wit. You
right.
See what I mean? There's
yes,
no emotion in it. Python and Forty Towers are really about emotion much more than pure wit. And the people who get quoted in humorous quotations are usually people like Oscar Wilde, who said witty things. They're very clever, but they're not actually profound in an emotional sense.
Well, that's John Cleese, the British comedic legend, film and TV actor, and founding member of Monty Python. John Cleese, thank you so much for joining us. It's been such a pleasure. Very grateful.
Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
John Cleese spoke with my co-host Anthony Brooks last year. Cleese's memoir, which came out in paperback last month, is called So Anyway. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.